Okay, welcome to the Saturday of the Graham Greene International Festival. It is a joy to see you all. I'm delighted there are so many of you here. We have a brilliant day ahead of us. Okay, so to John Baxter. So we are welcome to have with us today the acclaimed biographer John Baxter. John is a very well-known author of biographies of figures in film. They include J.D. Ballard, Stanley Kubrick, Robert De Niro, Woody Allen, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas. He has written guides to walking in Paris. I noticed they all sold yesterday. They looked great. That's well worth a read. He collected a great deal of Graham Greene over the years and documented this in his memoir, Confessions, well, A Pound of Paper, Confessions of a Book Addict. I, if I may say, happen to remember seeing this all the way back when it came out in 2002. I was doing an English degree and I saw it in a bookshop window. I thought, I really have to read that. And eventually I did get to read it and I was blown away. It is a wonderful, revealing read, both about John's life and about what many of us may share, which is the habit of collecting works by Graham Greene. And there are plenty on offer on both sides of the room, so you may like to stock up your collection today. So, he is married to Marie-Dominique Montel, who is a documentary maker, and it's worthwhile my saying she has made a documentary about Graham Greene and used his school when she made that documentary. So, who knows, perhaps we might see that one day. It was shown in France. So, without further ado, please can I introduce to you John Baxter.
Thanks, Martin. Thank you very much. Very glad to be here. Oh, I'm getting a little feedback. I'll stand a little further back. Is that okay? As Martin said, I was here many years ago with my wife to shoot a documentary here, but a lot of it comes back, actually. I suppose that's part of the quality of Green, the memory sticks. Speaking of memory, while I was preparing this little piece, I came across an item of Greeniana, which I doubt anybody here knows of. In the 70s, I taught at a college in the United States, and one of the grad students was a chap named John Stephen Fink. He's since earned a little eminence as a novelist, but he's probably better known for his magnum opus, Cluck, A History of Chickens in the Cinema. I think actually Cluck is more characteristic of John Stephen than his more sober works. And this is a creation of John Stephen's. Knowing of my interest in Graham Greene, he decided to play a sort of practical, literary practical joke. He was kind of notorious for these. When Richard Adams, the author of Watership Down, arrived at the college, John Stephen and his girlfriend greeted him at the airport, both dressed in full-length rabbit suits. His girlfriend with a handbag filled with carrots. I'm afraid that it was rather defused when the head of the English department pointed them out and said, I wonder if that has anything to do with you. And Adams, who, as you probably know, a rather snooty character, said, no, some sort of advertising. Where's the car? And leaving them to have to get back to the college in full-length rabbit suits. Anyway, he knew of my admiration for Greene. And every quarter, the English department produced something they called the Holland's Critic. It was a single short essay produced in this format, a single A3 sheet folded, and the a local artist, the college artist, contributed a pen and ink sketch of the particular author. And John Stephen arranged to produce one devoted to the fictions of Holly Martins from The Third Man, and got a quite nice drawing of Joseph Cotton as Holly Martins, and wrote a sort of learned little text. Millions of readers read the cheap, soft core editions of his three novels, The Oklahoma Kid, Death at Double X Ranch, and The Lone Rider of Santa Fe, as nothing more than thrilling adventure stories, which of course they were. But to those few discerning readers who possess one of the precious remaining copies of the early Martins, the publishers, WOW Productions of Lompoc, California, unforgivably shredded the entire unsold stock of Martins in 1962 when it shifted its forces to hardcore pornography, have found in them a gripping allegory of American history and morals. That Martins intended to stress these themes, lost innocence, conflict with the self, the closing of the range, the dangers of smoking loco weed, is demonstrated by the fact that all three novels tell the same story, the story of a man who hunts down a corrupt sheriff, victimizing his best friend. So, I mean, to go to all this trouble to produce this is really a considerable achievement, and I don't suppose it had any circulation outside the college and a few friends to whom I sent copies. But it was funny, it reminded me of just how all-pervasive the Green influence can be. I've drawn a little on a pound of paper for my remarks today, but I hope not excessively. It helped to revive my memory, and I couldn't think of a better way to say some of the things that I wanted to say about Green. We all remember the first time. I was 14, a pupil at a Catholic school in an Australian country town. Already, the contradictions of Catholicism were proving more interesting than its beliefs. The Jesuitical reasoning known as apologetics exerted an increasing appeal. A career in the church beckoned, a fate from which, arguably, I was saved by Graham Greene, his first intervention in the pattern of my life. I was out of sympathy with the sporty culture into which I'd been born. While my classmates pursued various varieties of ball in the midday sun, I haunted the public library. A Victorian pile, it was as silent and musty as an old church. Where better to encounter Green's work? Brighton Rock was the first, probably the Heinemann first edition, though its brick-red cloth binding had disappeared under the standard cockroach brown buckram. After a couple of chapters, it was clear I wouldn't be able to discuss this book with our priest, who liked to know what I was reading. What would he make of this world of tabloid journalists, racecourse touts, whatever they were, and razor gangs? I could hear him warning solemnly that such books represented an occasion of sin. Well, better and better. It intrigued me that Green's main character, Pinky, was a serious Catholic, but not in the sense that I understood Catholicism. Could there be varieties of belief, each valid in its own way? A personal Catholicism? On this and other similar Greenian concepts, the catechism was silent. When I finished Brighton Rock, I checked out A Gun for Sale and the wonderfully named Stamboul Train. But every few weeks, I'd borrow Brighton Rock again and keep it beside my bed. I was already collecting Green. All I lacked was the books. By the time I moved to London in the 70s, I'd read most of Green and even acquired a few of the more accessible first editions. But the transition to collecting required another defining moment. Back then, a flea market convened every Saturday on the waste ground behind Basil Spencer's sports centre at Swiss Cottage in North London. One morning, a new vendor had set up some trestle tables and covered them with books. They looked a cut above the usual market fare, but since most bargains were found with the amateurs who, like unseasonal picnickers, spread their blankets on the sodden ground and laid out their finds from jumble sales and charity shops, I headed for them first. Almost immediately, I struck it lucky with a first edition of Green's The Little Horse Bus, with the Dorothy Craigie illustrations, not the Artisone's, a real find. Tossed in a basket of exhausted felt animals, it was mine for a mere 5p. I headed back to the trestle tables, now manned by a very thin man in a ragged suit and black beret. Between two stained fingers, a mangled butt guttered in the moist morning air. To me, he suggested a minor league pickpocket. To Ian Sinclair, who was, of course, a book dealer before he was a novelist, he was more like the comedian Max Wall, with a dash of Blind Pew, the scarecrow pirate from Treasure Island. The better to scan his stock, I put the little horse bus on the table. The man's eyes assumed a sleepy expression, which I was to get to know well. He tilted his head like an inquisitive bird. Do you mind? He held out a skinny, trembling hand. I just found it, I said, nodding behind me, back there. Want to sell it? I didn't need to think. Not really, I said. A dealer generally meets people who want to sell him books, when his most pressing need is for those who want to buy. With two words, I'd sided with the buyers. Darting down the table, he grabbed two books and laid them before me. One was my favourite among Green's recent novels, Our Man in Havana. The other was In Search of a Character, his account of researching a burnt-out case in a Congo leprosarium. Years later, I'd have the chance to discuss Green's visit with Michel Lechat, his host and the book's dedicatee. £5 each, the dealer said. I looked down at the two books and the little horse bus. It took no imagination to visualise them next to my other Greens. In that instant, an accumulation became a collection. The seller, of course, was Martin Stone. Professionally, he was a rock guitarist, more talented, some people said, than even Eric Clapton. On the road with groups like Mighty Baby, Chilly Willy, and the Savoy Brown Blues Band, he'd filled the afternoons before a gig by checking out bookshops. Gradually, his hobby became a business. Actually, Martin told me once that he sold a lot to his former colleagues. Was it Robert Plant, somebody like that associated with Led Zeppelin, who only collected first editions of Clockwork Orange. Nothing else. He had like 50 of them. On Martin's advice, I took to visiting the Friday morning book market in the lanes behind the Angel in Islington. It was there that Ian Sinclair sold me my first signed Green item, another defining moment. In those days, I carried one of those leather man pouches. I couldn't have looked more out of place among the scruffs of Camden Passage had I worn plus fours and a deerstalker. Ian wrote later that my appearance on the scene signified the arrival of a new generation of collectors, more attentive to style, both in how we dressed and what we collected. Instead of Somerset Maugham, we bought Anthony Burgess, Thomas Pynchon instead of Aldous Huxley, Mervyn Peake, not Arthur Machen, and of course, Graham Greene. We were also more eager than preceding generations to meet writers and to have them inscribe our books. Signing sessions and literary festivals proliferated. No longer a scholarly pursuit, bibliophily metamorphosed into a contact sport. Writers reacted variously to the new collectors. Some looked on us as barely a cut above autograph hunters. To them, signing books was a chore. Others went too far in the opposite direction. Roald Dahl and James Baldwin inscribed their books with an extravagant love, followed by an exclamation mark, or sometimes a heart. James Ellroy, finding I was Australian, signed my copy of LA Confidential, Wombat Blood Drops! Exclamation mark. A few were alarmingly eccentric. Richard Hooker wouldn't sign copies of his book, MASH, The Story of Three Army Doctors, because he didn't profit from the subsequent film and TV series. The science fiction author Robert Heinlein, whose life had been saved by a blood transfusion, would only sign a book if the owner produced proof of a recent visit to a blood bank. Green had been a collector himself, of course. He understood our needs and catered to them. Why else produce those Christmas booklets with an extract from his latest book? Of course, they were a personal keepsake, but it was surely no accident that a few copies always found their way into the market, often through the Kensington bookshop of Green's nephew, Nick Dennis. We all learned to watch these, you know, we lurked around these shops, hoping for these things to come through. Though he avoided signing sessions, Green seemed happy to sign copies of his books, even if not asked. In a Bangkok opium den, drowsing between pipes, he noticed a few paperbacks, some of them his own, and duly inscribed them. Even his threat to destroy any copies of Babbling April that found their way into his hands had an adversarial quality, as if he was challenging us to find them before he did. It became a game to spot him on his occasional trips to London. Although technically incognito, he often visited those shops on Charing Cross Road where he and his brother Hugh had browsed for Edwardian crime fiction. Behind the desk of Nigel Burwood's Any Amount of Books, someone posted his photograph and wrote under it, "Give this man a discount." He would also visit the Cecil Court shop of Robert Criss. They had known one another since the 30s. When 20th Century Fox sued Green and the magazine Night and Day over his comments about Shirley Temple's precocious sexuality, Criss lent Green the money to flee to Mexico. Or so Criss claimed. If true, it's a landmark in the history of booksellers, a trade not noted for open-handedness. Bob lurked in his ill-lit shop like a bear in its cave. The stock was thick with dust, the aisles clogged with unshelved books. Time not only slowed here, it actually oozed backwards. As he elucidated scraps of bibliophile lore in his ursine growl, one half expected to hear the howl of an air raid siren and the putt, putt, putt of a doodle bug overhead. My visits to the shop never coincided with those by Green. Instead, Bob invited me to leave books with him, promising to get them inscribed. Green did so, but always to Criss himself, his ancient old friend. Bob then, with the brass face of the true dealer, sold my own books back to me. And of course I paid. People like Bob Criss contributed to my growing experience of bookmen, though I learned most from Martin Stone. From seller and client, our relationship developed into that of teacher and student, then into a friendship. Martin was not himself a collector, but what the trade calls a runner or scout. He sold his finds to dealers for the cash to go out and find more. As with anglers who hook the fish only to throw it back, his pleasure was in the chase. Since he couldn't drive, friends acted as a support group, chauffeuring him around the home counties and sometimes further afield. You probably know Ian Sinclair's Whitechapel Scarlet Tracings, which describes a trip with Martin to the Channel Islands, which is a nightmare. But all trips with Martin were nightmares. One of our expeditions to the Pacific Northwest and Canada is worth a book by itself. Among the venues to which our search took us on that trip was the locked-down ward of a mental hospital where a potential source of rarities was incarcerated on 24-hour suicide watch. But niceties played no part in Martin's practice. Once on the scent, he was relentless. Gate-crashing funerals, door-stepping bereaved relatives in stately homes, bribing housekeepers and suborning butlers, all was fair if it meant snatching a library from the jaws of Oxfam. The sniffing wasn't all literary. Driving up Archway Road one morning, we halted at a red light. Martin took advantage of the pause to extract a small mirror and a razor blade from his pocket and, ignoring the police station a few metres away, began chopping cocaine. Shunning banks, he dealt only in cash. From time to time, I financed a purchase on the promise that we would split the profits. On one occasion, a young man cleaning out the home of a recently deceased relative invited us to make an offer on the library. Imagine our delight at finding scores of thrillers and comic novels from the 20s and 30s, all in their precious and fragile dust wrappers. Woodhouse, Buchan, Ambler, even a couple of greens. "Well, what do you think?" asked the young man. "Anything you can use?" Oh dear," Martin said, apparently flustered. In moments of stress, he betrayed his middle-class origins. He didn't quite wring his hands, but that was the effect. "I suppose," he stammered, would you take 200 for the lot?" Said with more confidence, the offer might have seemed insultingly low, but Martin's nervousness, not to mention his bedraggled wardrobe, implied that £200 was all he had in the world. "And you'll take them tonight?" the young man asked. "Car's outside," I said, reaching for my checkbook. Every minute as we loaded up, we expected the seller to change his mind. But this just added to the experience. I'd already discovered one of the great pleasures of the dealer's life, that of not giving a sucker an even break. I shouldn't have been surprised that Martin applied the same rules to his friends. Cashing in proved increasingly difficult. Deals were either in progress or about to be closed, or closed but the money hadn't been paid, or if paid, had been used to buy some fresh items. Hoping to salvage at least something for my money, I helped myself to the Graham Greens for my collection. This sparked an argument in which I recognised the twitching paranoia of cocaine. "I could get a couple of bills for those," Martin grumbled as I extracted the books. "But I gave you the money to buy them." "You'll get it back, you'll get it back." "When?" "Soon, soon." He waved towards that rosy future which, for all runners, recedes more speedily the closer they approach. "Well, let me know when it arrives," I said. "We can settle up then." I didn't see him for a few days. When I did, he was his old amiable self. But no money was ever forthcoming. In 1989, both Martin and I moved independently to France, I to marry, and Martin to evade embarrassing questions from the police about certain mood-enhancing herbal compounds. Actually, there was something I wish I could have filmed. The first time Marie-Dominique met Martin Stone, she was pregnant. We're walking on a very narrow street, the sidewalks, very narrow in Paris, and down came Martin towards changed his beret for an old felt hat with a hole in the corner from which he attached a piece of string so it didn't blow away. His clothes were covered in cigarette ash. He'd lost all his teeth and he was limping on two metal crutches because he'd, in an excess of glee at the bicentennial, he'd leapt from the plinth in the middle of one of the big plus in Paris and broken the bones in both his ankles so he could hardly walk. But of course I recognised my old friend. I said, "Martin!" And I looked at Marie-Dominique and she, horror! Who was this apparition that I was embracing? I think she would have probably ended the marriage right there if she could. One of the more quirky demonstrations of Green's francophilia was the novel Loser Takes All. It describes how a quixotic millionaire rewards a timid accountant by offering to pay for his honeymoon in Monaco, then apparently forgets him. Stranded, the accountant develops a gambling system that makes him rich, but threatens to destroy the marriage before it begins. The novel became a mediocre movie, called in France, I Lost My Wife at Monte Carlo. The producer was John Stafford, whom Green once described ruefully as too nice a man to be in the film business. Stafford also produced those other Green adaptations, Across the Bridge and The Stranger's Hand, both, like Loser Takes All, traduced by eccentric choices of director or star, frequently from Italy, where Stafford often went to scrape up financing. The role of the accountant in Loser Takes All suggested some unassuming British actor like Alec Guinness. Instead, he cast Italian matinee idol Rosano Brazzi. The film never recovered. But I have a soft spot for the film, since in a roundabout way, it enriched my collection. Alerted by another dealer that Stafford's daughter had retained a number of Green's first editions, all inscribed, I made my way one morning to his former home in a seedily genteel corner of West London. A few hours later, I wove my way to the tube station, rubber-kneed from having shared with the lady an entire bottle of gin, drunk neat at room temperature from those little tumblers painted with brightly coloured flowers in which processed cheese was sold. Green would have approved. My collecting of green ended as randomly as it began. Martin had shown me that the primary pleasure of collecting lies in finding and acquiring. And after two decades, I'd found and acquired almost everything, including even the elusive babbling April. Right on cue, or so it seemed at the time, a friend emailed me from New York. She'd just been hired to run the rare book department of a large auction house. Did I have anything for her first sale? The same day, another friend rang. She was returning to the US after a year's secondment in London. Her allowance for repatriating personal effects was generous. Was there anything that I needed shipped back to the USA? In a scene from Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, all the planets of the solar system line up with the black monolith in perfect equilibrium. This seemed such a moment. I asked my friend to reserve a few tea chests and emailed the other, "Would you like to sell my Graham Greene collection?" The sale yielded a generous profit on what I'd paid for the items, though if I costed in my time, I was well out of pocket. But considering the pleasures of having compiled the collection, I felt amply repaid. Later in life, Greene confessed to Rick Joukowsky, who bought the library in his Antibes apartment, that had he not become a writer, he'd have liked to do as Rick did and deal in rare books. I could see why the idea appealed to Greene. Book dealing harmonized with another of his preoccupations, espionage. Numerous films and novels have used bookshops as a front for spying. Greene wrote one into The Human Factor, perhaps inspired by the unmasking in 1961 of London booksellers Helen and Peter Kroeger as Soviet agents. They passed secrets in the books they mailed overseas, no doubt including a few Greenes. As long as I collected him, I felt linked to Greene as only the secret agent and his quarry can be. "The greatest pleasure of being a writer," he wrote, "was to spy on other people." How much more pleasurable, then, to spy on the writer who said that? After all this, we never actually met. That's as it should be, in my opinion. Between watcher and watched, at least the hint of a barrier should prevail, as the gauze of the confessional separates confessor and penitent. But entering a dingy lane in the East End of London, I sometimes thought I saw his tall, stooped figure turning the corner at the other end, or, dipping my fingers in the font of a suburban chapel, glimpsed him slipping out a side door into the drizzly afternoon. Many years have passed since I shared his world, but at times I see him still. Thank you.
Thank you, John, for a really generous, hospitable approach to looking at Graham Greene and the windows through which authors view writers and vice versa, of course, literal and metaphorical windows. I'm sure many of you will empathise with John's habit of collecting, and I wonder whether we have any questions. We have plenty of time for questions. Would any of you like to ask John a question?
Just waiting for people to put their hands up. Can I just ask, what was the best Graham Greene you ever bought for your collection?
The best in the terms of a collectible or something to read?
Either way.
I suppose, let me think. Well, I tended to judge things in terms of the difficulty of getting them. And one I remember was... Greene, you know, used to offer things to charity auctions and things like that, and he signed a copy of one of quite obscure limited edition, and he gave it to the people who counsel potential suicides,
the Samaritans.
Samaritans, yes, and they were having an auction. So I thought I'd like to know more about this, so I rang up the Samaritans, and accidentally I got onto a counsellor, and so I said, I'd like to know something about the Graham Greene. Yes, yes, what's your name exactly? I said, well, my name is John Baxter. Yes, yes, John, now, how can I help you? I said, well, I want to know about... I said, I'm sorry, you're not, are you all right? You're feeling okay? I mean, yes, yes, but and of course, the more he didn't get it, the more agitated I became, the more I must have looked like I was on the edge. So it went on like some distance like that. But I did get the book in the end, yes. Those are the hard ones, to get those little fascicules, as they call them in French, little leaflets and booklets, and you know the stuff that the Christmas booklets with the Artisone.
Oh, of course.
Actually, that was I got so interested in those, I started to collect Artisone as well, and that's often the way. There's a sort of metastasizing, I think, in collecting. You start with one writer, then you think of the people that are Artisone talked about being influenced by a very early edition of Pilgrim's Progress. Mm-hmm. Well, I bought that as well, and then I started to buy books by the person who... I mean, you know, it just went on and on, really. It's yes. A disease. That's
right. Arms coming out.
Yes, the gentleman over there.
I wonder if I can ask your advice about something. I'm wondering if I can ask your advice about something.
Advice, yes.
Yes. What would you
take
say?
Take two aspirin and see me in the morning.
What would you say to a person who isn't a collector and is overwhelmed by boxes of books, some present in his flat, some in a storage locker? And I am asking for a friend.
Yes. Okay. I don't know if I got this exactly. What advice would I give to somebody who had a lot of books?
And so, it's not necessarily a collector.
Really? The reverb here is terrible.
So the question is, Richard would like to know what advice you might offer to someone who has a habit of obtaining books, but is not necessarily a collector of books,
right,
and is overrun by books in their property.
And what should you do with them?
Yes, exactly.
Well, yes, okay. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
The reverb. I know the feeling. I have two garages full, I don't know quite what to do with them. Many of them 10 years ago would have been very negotiable, saleable books.
Yeah.
But of course, the rise of the internet has utterly changed the whole trade. So now you cannot give books away.
Yes.
The American Library in Paris, which used to accept the libraries of distinguished expatriates, and some wonderful stuff I found there. Mm. They just won't accept books any longer. Most places, even Oxfam, you know, they'll accept books, mainly they'll rip out the print block and it gets pulped. In fact, one of the most depressing sights I've ever seen is a basement at Oxfam. They've got people sitting there with heaps of books, grabbing the covers, ripping out the print block, throwing the print block into a tea chest and throwing away the boards because the pulpers won't pulp boards.
Yes, okay.
There is no easy answer. What you can do is that if you can find in the accumulation a few things that are valuable, that are unusual, if they're signed, if they're very attractive, if they have the wrappers, you can usually sell them. The high end of the market still exists, and in fact it's even more vital now than it was. You know, prices are going up in the upper levels. But yeah, if you're talking about books you bought to read or even minor collectibles and everything, really, you might as well make a bonfire. Sadly,
that's helpful.
So I wish I could tell you something happier, but I live with this myself.
Very good.
Jen. Hello.
Hi.
Do you ever regret giving up your collection and thus giving up your relationship with Green?
Regret giving up the collection or not having met Green?
Both.
Both.
And thus giving up your relationship with him in a way.
No, I don't regret not, to answer the second part first, I don't regret not meeting Green because I feared it would be a little like an incident that James Thurber describes in his essay, A Guide to the Literary Pilgrimage. A friend went to see the writer William Bolitho, who lived in the south of France. And Bolitho said, what I suggest is, I will talk for an hour and then you will talk for an hour. And the man said all he could think of in the first hour was what was he going to say in the second hour. Yeah. And when his hour came around, all he could think to say was over and over again, "Mighty pretty place you've got here." So I feared that with Green I would say, you know, "Where did you get that shirt?" or something equally inane, because I would be thinking, you know, if I could come up with some deeply significant statement. Yeah. And so I obviously I'd be just preoccupied with that and I wouldn't get any pleasure out of it. I think Rick Joukowsky has a better way of operating, because there's a lordly, as you know, if, I don't know if you know Rick, but very lordly quality about Rick. Big cigars, you know, and the beard and everything. And one feels, writers feel on an equal level with him. He told me recently, he said, Bernie Taupin, who writes, lyrics, his wife turned up one Christmas morning. He said, "I forgot to buy something for Bernie. What can I buy?" And he said, "Well, I know he likes Lolita, and I've got the two-volume Olympia Press Lolita signed by Nabokov." And she said, how much? And he thought, "I could say a million, it wouldn't matter. You know, these people have more money and they know what to do with." He said it was a genuine moral dilemma. You know, how greedy could I be and still live with myself? Your first part was, do I regret giving up the collection? No, not at all. I never went back to collecting Green.
Right.
I collect other people. Now I just recently sold an Olympia Press collection, all of this sort of literary and quasi-porn and so on. I collect stuff about Josephine Baker, if any of you have a little something from the Folies Bergère tucked away. I still collect books published in Paris between the wars. Mm. So I've got a lot of Obelisk Press, Olympia, a lot of Beckett and people like that. So no, the collecting nerve never goes away, but you apply it to different. It's like love stories, I suppose. You fall for one woman, then you fall for another woman. You know, you don't feel you've got to go back to the first one all the time. Life goes on. Sorry.
I have a small question, if the audience don't mind me asking. I worked as a librarian in a past life.
Right.
And I discovered that librarians and libraries are very reluctant to part with the books they have because there's an attachment to them. So that they want to do something specific with them. And I wondered what your thoughts were about what the relationship is between the habit of collecting and your own professional writerly interests. I associate collecting with pleasure, writing with work. Of course, there's cross-fertilization. Yeah. But if you go into any professor's office, you will see books everywhere, of course, depending on the size of the room. Mm. And many of them will go unread. If you've seen the documentary on Jack Derrida, you will see his huge library, and he says he hasn't read half of it. So what are your thoughts on that, please?
Yes. It's interesting, actually. When I was a collector, or a more assiduous collector than I am now, I suppose, I resented libraries. I hated them because they would take a book and just ruin it. Especially the lending libraries of my childhood, you know, they automatically rebound the book in this awful bombazine, you know, so that it was more robust. And then, of course, I learned about Boots Libraries, which was, I don't know, probably you never experienced the Boots Libraries, but I came in on the fag end of Boots Libraries. They were a lending library, of course, based in the pharmacist's chain. I mean, it's an odd combination. Why would there be a lending library in a chemist shop? But anyway, that was the case. And their system was they would buy new novels. They would take the wrappers off and keep them. Then they would rebind the book in their very basic cloth. And then very often they would put into the spine a wire sort of spill with a little hook on the top, which make it easier to grab the books from the library and put them back in again. And it was also a security thing because, if a book like that with the wire in it was a giveaway. And then at the end of the year, they would get all the books back again and put the wrappers back on them and put a little sticker that said 1 and 6 pence or something like that. And then they would sell them in the shop. Well, it was wonderful. You know, you'd find a beautiful first edition of Mask of Demetrios with the wrapper on it. You'd open it up and it'll be rebound in this awful thing. But it was still the first edition. So how valuable was that? I mean, did you price it based on the wrapper or on the book? So I hated that. Okay. And also these stamps.
Yes.
Why do they feel they've got to put stamps in every... Well, I know it's to stop people from stealing. So, yes, I had an ambiguous attitude to libraries. Then as I began to accumulate books, I suppose I followed Anthony Powell, books really furnish a room. Mm. Okay. I thought a room full of books is a wonderful, it's a beautiful thing. And, of course, you've got to remember, I began collecting just at that moment when people no longer threw away dust wrappers. Up until then, it was usual to throw away the wrapper because people liked that nice, even spines of red and brown and green, you know. You see that so often in older shops. But suddenly, wrappers, you know, that was the story. Bell Book and Radmore down in Covent Garden, you'd just sort of glue your nose to the glass. And, you know, some people sort of would admire clothes and shoes and everything. With us, it was dust wrappers. And I remember the three-volume Titus Groan, Gorman Gast, and Titus Alone with the Mervyn Peake things. That started me collecting Mervyn Peake. I just loved those wrappers. So the fact that libraries would throw away the wrappers like that really drove us crazy.
Yeah.
So I thought, I've got to rescue these books before the libraries get at them. So that's when I really began to collect, simply for decorative purposes, as much as anything. And so our apartment is just filled we have a house down in the south, and that's full of books.
Yes.
And I've got two garages in Montmartre. You know, what can you say?
Do your collections direct what you then write about?
Sorry.
Do your collections direct what you choose to write about in your books?
Uh-huh. Do they? Well, that's an interesting question, actually. Do they? Well, you know, when I moved to Paris, I began writing something rather different to what I'd written before. I started to write biographies of film people. And for every time you write a biography, you accumulate an enormous amount of books. And so I have more books about Stanley Kubrick than you've had hot breakfast, you know. And some of them I've kept.
Yeah.
I did a book about Joseph von Sternberg, and I had a lot of quite early rare things, so yes, I keep those in the house. I don't know. I can't separate the two. No. You know, writers are very self-deluding, aren't they?
Yeah.
We convince ourselves that we've just got to have this, otherwise we couldn't do the book as it should be. But the truth is, it's vanity. You know.
Yeah.
Marie-Dominique is a lot more controlling. But then filmmakers are different, aren't they?
Anyone else, please? Yes. Go ahead, please, James.
Did your relationship with Driff come to a happy end?
Driff.
And did Driff?
With my relationship with Driff, I didn't get the last part. Well, nobody quite knows what happened to Driff. Driff is a rather strange guy called Driffield, his real name, I made a note of his real name. He was very mysterious. He was one of these runners at the same time as Martin. And he used to dress really bizarrely, sometimes really in plus fours. Sometimes he would have a bow tie, but it turned out to be made of Kleenex. Mm. He just knotted a piece of Kleenex. He put this book together called Driff's Guide, which was a guide to almost every rare bookshop in Britain. And the reviews were so sulphurous that most of the time he was not allowed back in to the shop. But he did turn up all sorts of extraordinary things. He produced a newsletter. But he became increasingly eccentric. When I first met him, he was offering to sell you a ticket to his funeral.
Very in advance.
He'd compiled the order of service with the music, And he was collecting books about funerals and death. And that's how I met him, because he wanted to buy my copy of The Bell Jar of Sylvia Plath, because it was a book about suicide. Mm. And I didn't sell it to him, but anyway, he continued to collect. And he said that he was going to be immolated on a pyre made up of his books about suicide. And I was relatively new to this, and so I thought, this guy's crazy, surely, you know. And so I said to another dealer, maybe it was Ian or something, I said, Driff, he's a bit weird, isn't he? And they said, well, yes, I suppose he's a bit strange. And I said, this is the thing about the suicide and everything. They said, oh, no, that's great. I mean, that's a new thing, you know. I mean, before he was really crazy, but, you know, I mean, all he wants to do is burn his body on a pile of books. So that's quite normal, you know.
Yes,
and then he kind of disappeared. He came under a cloud because he had, there was something about a girl that he took to Paris. There was some money, I don't know, I'm not even sure if he's still alive, but he hasn't been extant, as they say, for a while. But yeah, he was one of the classic runners. They were a strange group, very odd. I used to think Martin was weird. After a while, I realised he was somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Another level, very good. Any more questions, please? Okay. We're towards a close there then. Thank you, John, for a wonderfully entertaining talk.
Thank you.
And series of questions and answers.